Welcome to I'm In, the Institute of Hospitality's official podcast hosted by me, Phil Streets, FIH. Today we're looking into building a stable business, and joining me to chat this one through, we have Jacob Gallant, AIH, Mark Grant, MIH, and Peter Russell, FIH. As always, a huge thank you to all three of them for giving up their time and opinion. Don't forget, if you'd like to be a guest on the show, just reach out to me directly at the email in the show notes. But for now, let's go and learn how to build a stable business. Hello and welcome to the next episode of I'm In, the Institute of Hospitality's official podcast, hosted, as always, by me, Phil Street, FIH. Out of the world at the moment, or out in the world at the moment, I should say, it seems like we are getting bombarded with constant news of business challenges, with rising costs and staffing issues and all of these things never too far away from conversation. So, with that in mind, we thought it might be a good idea to have a chat around how to build a stable business, to see if there's any golden nuggets out there that might help people in the time that we find ourselves in. I am, of course, not going to do that alone. I have enlisted the help of three wonderful human beings who've all given up their time very kindly to have this chat with us today. So first up from within the fellowship, we have Peter Russell, who is, if I've got this correctly, CTO and COO for the Russell Partnership.
Correct, yes. Thank you very much for having me. As you said, my name is Peter Russell, and I work for Russell Partnership Collection. We are the UK's leading food, nutrition, technology and wellbeing collection. And that means that we deliver consultancy, which helps to create, guide and mobilise transformational strategies for our clients. And that covers sort of food and beverage and hospitality across a whole variety of sectors, including business and industry, major events, stages and arenas, universities and hotel and hospitality. And thanks again for having me on the podcast.
Oh, you're very welcome. That you're well drilled, straight in, no problems at all. Is it just complete coincidence that your name happens to be Russell and you're working for a company called the Russell Partnership, or do you have a deeper involvement?
I do, yes. So the Russell Partnership was set up in 1989 by David Russell, our founder and chairman, who is my uncle. The short version of the long story is that I'd never really planned to work for the collection, even though I don't want that to sound like I didn't want to. But it was through a variety of sort of channels of my early career, and then that led to an opportunity to work for the collection back in 2011. And I've been here ever since, and delighted to be working my way forwards. And as you said, I'm very fortunate to be, now be having the FIH designation, which I was awarded last year. So we do a lot of work with the Institute, and was thrilled to take up the opportunity to be here on the podcast.
Fantastic. Good man. All right. And next up from within the MIH ranks, we have Mark Grant, who is Sales Director at EP&T Global. Have I got that right?
You have got that right. Absolutely spot on. And again, thank you for having me, Phil. Yes, I'm the Sales Director for the UK, Europe, and I also do some work in the Americas. EP&T are a business that are focused on building optimization. What that means is we help companies reduce their energy consumption and therefore reduce their carbon footprint and their operating costs. So we use technology to measure, aggregate, and then intervene to help them reduce their energy consumption.
Right. Oh, I would imagine then that there's definitely going to be a subject matter in this conversation that you can absolutely speak to.
I think so. You know, it's a subject that is increasingly relevant to society as well as to business. And that comes with some good points and some challenges. And some of those are around how we use those terms and also how we apply them, as well as not just as a corporate thinking perspective, but also as individuals. You know, we contribute to the operation of our business from our own values and moral standpoint. Sometimes that aligns with our employer, sometimes it doesn't. It's an interesting subject.
Yeah, absolutely. Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for joining us as well. And then finally, from within our AIH members and joining us from the other side of the pond, we have Jacob Gallant, Sales Manager at the Hilton Harrisburg in Pennsylvania.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
You're very, very welcome. Gallant by name, gallant by nature, I hope.
I try. That is the hope.
And I'm sure you've never heard that one before, but there we are. So just give us a little snapshot of where you're working, Jacob.
Yes. So I serve as the Corporate and Government Sales Manager here at the Hilton Harrisburg. We are in the capital of Pennsylvania. So my role is really centered around forging the strong relationships in the community and with our partners, and then crafting our sales strategies that are going to be tailored to meet the needs of our corporate and government clients.
Good stuff. Yeah. And we haven't had that many people from the States on the show. How's the view over there in hospitality at the moment? Do you have much of the same challenges we're experiencing here in terms of rising costs and staffing issues?
Yes, that definitely seems to be a universal problem.
Yeah. Well, I mean, hopefully we've all got all of the solutions that anyone can ever need for that. But thank you for joining us, and especially because of the time difference as well. It's much appreciated. Before we get into the topic, I'd love to ask everybody who comes on the show why they said I'm in and joined the Institute of Hospitality in the first place. So I'll come back to you first, Peter. Why did you say I'm in to the IOH?
I think for many reasons. As I said, recently was very grateful to be brought in to the fellowship in terms of having the FIH status. I've sort of worked with the Institute on various things over the years, predominantly the Passion for Hospitality event, where I introduced the HOTS business game to that back in 2015. So we're sort of fast approaching 10 years of delivering that. And, you know, I worked very closely with Peter Ducker, who is your previous managing director, and now know Robert Richardson very well, and many other people across the Institute. And just always enjoyed working with everyone, whether they work for the Institute or the members. So, yeah, was thrilled to get the opportunity to be part of the podcast.
Good stuff. Excellent. And yeah, same question to you, Mark. Why did you say I'm into the IOH?
Well, although I'm in a slightly different sector at the moment, I was involved in the hospitality sector and hotels for over 15 years. And one of the things I really liked about that sector is the range of skills and the roles that come together. For me, hospitality is one of the fundamental human traits, you know, welcoming people into your home, into your culture. And I think that's something that is a good thing for society. I really enjoyed running hotels, you know, and I think one of the reasons I perhaps moved on is that as I was more and more successful, I moved further and further away from the guests. So it's the diversity of roles, diversity of people, and obviously the geographical range really appealed to me.
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose today's a case in point, as we have Jacob on the show as well, from the other side of the, I was going to say the planet, but not quite. But but the same question to you, Jacob, why did you say I'm into the IOH?
Yeah, so I don't recall when I first became aware of the IOH, but when I did, it was something of interest to me straight away. Joining was a decision really driven by a desire to connect with like-minded professionals and people who are passionate about the industry from across the world. So that combined with the excellent resources and training that IOH provides, this podcast, of course, being at the top of that list, certainly drove me to say
again. Yeah, no, so you make a good point, though, as well, in terms of, I think it's just one of the wonderful things about the IOH is the fact that sometimes when in your own four walls or your own country, you get kind of, I suppose, blinkered into your own set of problems. But in actual fact, the set of problems that we have are, as you said, probably shared across the vast majority of the world within hospitality. So to have that opportunity to share resource and knowledge, I think is just, you know, I mean, you can't really put a price on it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, good stuff. All right, well, let's get to it then. Today's topic, as I said at the head of the show, was all about exploring building a stable business. And so I wanted to find a quote from business, and I landed on this: play by the rules, but be ferocious. And that's from the founder of Nike, Phil Knight. It's a good name. I've never met a bad Phil yet. So keeping that advice in mind, let's strip this back to basics. My opening question today is going to be really just centered around what are currently some of the primary pressures that hospitality businesses commonly face? And anyone can feel free to jump in on that.
I'm happy to come in first. I think there's lots of things. I know you mentioned a few things in your initial sort of section and introduction, things like labour challenges, and then that sort of leads into things like regulatory issues. I think one of the big things that we see is the, you know, things like economic fluctuations have a really big impact on the hospitality industry. I think because the, you know, hotels, restaurants, hospitality are all quite highly sensitive to these economic cycles. So, you know, during these periods, it has a big impact on what people spend, what their habits are. And then, of course, with high competition linked with that, as you just mentioned, being ferocious, then, you know, it's a very competitive environment to be within. I think the sort of third part to that would be also with changing consumer preferences, that high competition leads to a very fast-paced nature of being, you know, having to be able to quickly handle those things in order to be, you know, best placed to do as you say and deal with those pressures. So I think there's sort of those two or three elements for me that all link together that lead to that pressure.
Yeah, and obviously we find ourselves in a moment in time where there are specific pressures. Is it a case whereby, in actual fact, whatever time you find, there's always going to be some kind of pressure?
In our view, yeah, I think that, you know, there's always going to be pressure. It's very rare. I mean, there may be short periods of time where there's sort of minimalized pressure. You know, there's always opportunities where maybe things all seem to be going very well. But I think largely those are probably very short windows. So yeah, I think, you know, there's always going to be a challenge. It's a case of what is the challenge of the day and how are you dealing with it? And I think, you know, it's also what is the combination of those challenges and what do they mean to each other? So, you know, the combination of those challenges will not always be the same. And you may be quite used to dealing with the challenge of two particular things, but then that might change to something else. And then the combination might have unintended consequences or unexpected consequences that you weren't imagining. And then you, of course, then have to sort of work out how to deal with those.
Mm. Yeah. Mark, I think you were going to jump in and say something before I cut you off.
That's okay. I like the quote. I think that's really poignant, you know, about follow the rules. The problem is the rules keep changing, whereas the objective tends to remain the same. The objective being success, if you like, or, you know, happy customers. The rules, however, keep changing. And some examples, I think, are if we look at change in working habits following COVID, for example, people are now working at home far more, which is reducing corporate travel and therefore the requirement for hospitality services. If we look at changing rules around our changing environment, changing regulations about how buildings need to operate and what regulations are in place. So the rules keep changing, and how furiously you pursue them, I think, dictates your success. So if I would prefer to change the word furious to being agile, because I think we need to be considered in change. While the rules keep changing, it's whether we follow them or whether we set them. And I think that's an important point for me.
Yeah, very good. Yeah. And I suppose that's the thing, that and that's always going to be something where the rules are always going to change, right? I mean, just even look at things like governance around taxation rates and things like that, that seem to be always in the public eye in terms of what we're trying to do to maybe get them a little bit better for businesses to flourish. But at the same time, that is the rules of the land. So you've got to kind of just, yeah, you can kind of, I suppose, shout about it a little bit, but you've kind of just got to get on with it.
Yeah, certainly from my point of view, I work with a lot of asset capital companies who own hotel premises. And for them, the important part for them as a stakeholder may be different for the operator as a stakeholder, which again may be different from the expectations of the guest as a stakeholder or the team member as a stakeholder. So I think aligning common rules or common objectives is a really important principle in stability in business and in success. And the ability to communicate that in a transparent way, I think, is a really key element of the leadership in each of these businesses.
Absolutely. Jacob, do you have anything to add from anything that we've just covered, I guess, across two key points, really?
Yeah, I mean, just building on what was already said, our industry just kind of lives in an unpredictable setting. We are here to serve people, and their wants and needs and what is going to drive their wants and needs is subject to change at any time and without much of a heads up for us. And that is always a pressure that's going to keep us kind of on our toes to be able to adapt to whatever is coming at any point.
Yeah. I suppose that in some ways that's not a bad thing. Like, you know, the minute you get comfortable with something is the minute where potential problems start occurring. If you're kind of constantly on your toes, I mean, I'm sure we'd all like a day or two whereby you don't have to be on your toes, but to be in that kind of state of mind where you feel like, you know, change is inevitable, so I need to be ready for it, it's probably got to be a good state of mind to be in.
I think it also forces innovation to a degree. You know, we always have to be looking for a way to be better and a way to be better prepared for what's coming. And that's going to drive new ideas and new innovation that will keep raising the level of the entire industry across the board.
Yeah, absolutely. Mark, you're going to say something.
Yeah, I think the sector is well equipped to deal with change in terms of evolution. I think it's when you have unpredictable change put upon you, it makes it extremely challenging, certainly from a business planning point of view. And examples of that may be a pandemic or energy prices or changes in food supply because of global events elsewhere. And I think it's those elements that really throw the cat amongst the pigeons in terms of providing stability in terms of your pricing, because customer loyalty is obviously down to good service, great product, but it's also about transparency and consistency in pricing. And as we see at the moment, even doing your own supermarket shopping, the price of a loaf of bread or some butter changes every time I go in, it seems. And that creates uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And that is difficult to forecast as a business. When, how do you forecast your income if you can't forecast your cost base. And I think that's a real tricky one.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, let's focus on that. Are there anything, any fundamentals that a business listening to that who will be agreeing with you, no doubt, that they can implement or just, you know, I suppose just have a very basic focus on? If you get that right, then you're setting a reasonable foundation in what is a changing landscape.
I think in part for me is, and I'm going to contradict myself, I think, here, is that if you look at across the hospitality sector, that there's some concepts, if you like, hotel concepts that are rigid in what they do, very disciplined. You get the same thing wherever you go consistently. And that's a good thing as a brand because it creates trust and loyalty. But also in a changing environment, sometimes I'd like them to change the price a little bit or change something else a little bit to offer me something different. So I think that having worked in the budget sector and operated those hotels for a few years, the real strength of those propositions was the consistency in the product. You knew what you were going to get every time you went. Inevitably, for commercial reasons, the price would fluctuate for all the reasons we all understand in hospitality. And that's where the value judgment comes in, because where you have complete transparency in your offering and your service style, but you don't have transparency in how you've arrived at the price, it creates doubt in your customer's mind. And they then take that back to a sense of value. Do I feel I'm getting value or not? And at that sense, you almost feel as you're losing control of your own operation a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Peter, anything to add into that?
No, I think Mark summarized that incredibly well. I think, you know, looking for the knowns that you can find and then trying to sort of bring in as much sort of reassurance and the consistency element, I think, is really important. You know, as was just being said, you know, most and pretty much all hotels, restaurants, hospitality brands are striving to be as consistent as possible, which is difficult in those times of an uncertainty. So I think, you know, where you can bring in elements of control, then that's important. But I think it's important to try and foresee as much as you possibly can in terms of what's coming up. I think one of the sort of in a past life, I worked in event management, organizing conferences, and one of the things that we would do as part of that process would always be the sort of what if analysis. So you'd always try and think through for every stage of what you were doing, what are the possible things that could go against the plan, and then what would we do to solve them so that you were better prepared for them. And I think it's the same with a business plan, and you know, and any kind of business planning, it's you know, we don't want those things to happen, but it's strategizing to, well, if they do happen, what are we going to do, and then how are we going to react to that? So, you know, we've got a plan B, a plan C, a plan D. So I think those are the important things that I would see in terms of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Jacob, anything to add into that?
I don't think there's anything of value for me to add to that. Very well said.
Well, I mean, I suppose, you know, I think the key point that we've highlighted so far is just this need for agility, as you put it, Mark, in terms of your ability to adapt to whatever comes. Of course, there are going to be things that come up that you can't immediately adapt to because it comes to as a bit of a shock to the system. And obviously the pandemic is a really shining example. I don't want to call that the pandemic a shining example, but anyway. But what then can businesses do? If change is inevitable, what can they do to, I suppose, prepare to be ready for change?
I'm happy to come in first on that. I think the key thing here is about building that resilience. And I know that feels like a very easy thing to say. And you know, it's actually delivering it, which is the difficult part. I think, you know, there's different ways to do that. And again, that's going to depend on how your business is structured and what your business is. So whether that's through, you know, optimizing your supply chain, whether that's through, you know, like we just talked about, that risk management and contingency planning, whether that's through strengthening your workforce so that you're better prepared for these things. And that, like I said at the start, diversifying your offering and your revenue streams so that you know, you have other things to fall back on. It may be that you don't utilize all those revenue streams all the time, but having that sort of diverse portfolio of things that you deliver then, you know, creates more opportunities when you need them. I think that would be the sort of starting point from the way that we would see it.
Yeah. Jacob, Mark, anything to throw into that?
I think for me, one of the important things is empathy. If you can empathize with your customer and empathize with your supplier in terms of the challenges they're facing, in terms of the relationship with you, I think that helps everybody to find a common ground. I've always said in a sales role, in a negotiation, you always start with the things you agree on. So with suppliers, with customers, what is the common theme that brings us together? So if I can deliver that, where can I lose some of the, and I use this term reluctantly, fluff, if we can remove some of that? What is the core motivation for you to buy from me? And how can I deliver that? And as long as you can do that in a way that they feel value, I think you retain custom and you retain meaningful relationships.
Yeah, absolutely. Jacob, your view.
Sure. I'll just kind of build on what Mark was just saying there with keeping those relationships and maintaining that. I think that also applies to our teams and our internal staff by keeping that focus on taking care of them and promoting good work environments and those relationships. When we fall into hard times, such as the pandemic, we have that foundation of a workforce who are willing to go to bat and suggest these ideas and be willing to pivot how they're operating to best suit our vendors and our customers and keep the business successful through those hard times.
Yeah, I mean, you segued very, very nicely into the people, which was actually where I was going to go to next in any case, because, I mean, obviously, I think we could probably all agree that part of building a stable business is maintaining a stable place to work. And I mean that in the nicest possible way. You know, you want to create a place that people actually want to come to work. We already mentioned at the beginning of this around the change that's happened towards there's a lot more people working from home. I know that there are companies who are actively trying to strategize reasons to bring people back in to offices. But I think in terms of office uptake at the moment, there's a lot of investors looking at changing, converting use into hotel spaces because they're just not filling the capacities. I mean, that's one part of culture, of course. It's, you know, giving people the flexibility to do that. And if you work in operations, then, of course, working from home is nigh on impossible. But what do businesses need to focus on from a cultural perspective to ensure that they're building that right level of stability?
I'll jump in, Phil. I think there needs to be a bit of a cultural shift. Times are changing, you know, as we've alluded to with several examples. But what hasn't really changed is the fundamentals of employer contractual relations. And for me, this is a good example. And I'll use the term again about negotiation, because change, dealing with change is negotiation. You either accept it or you resist it. And I think I think not so long ago, people used to celebrate the fact that a job wasn't for life because it promoted transience and trying different things and all that. But in the times, you know, people might reflect differently on that now after the last few years and actually will embrace stability. And I think part of that onus shouldn't just be on the employee. There should be an onus on the employer. And the examples I would use are things like travel costs. So with the hospitality industry, you are location dependent. You need to be in that building to deliver your role. And travel costs are going up. It should almost be, I think, you know, the employers, that should be part of the package that covers your travel to it, as an example. Or it should cover other things that will retain you as an employee, whether that's healthcare, because, you know, we all in the UK, we rely on the NHS, but that has its issues. I think that's where you will gain greater commitment from employees. And why not bring back a job for life where you can stay in a business, consistently add value? And, I, you know, not everybody has to end up being the CEO. We're all familiar with the term promoting to a level of incompetence. Some people are just great at what they do and they're happy with what they do. So let's reward them for that. Just because you're not climbing the corporate ladder doesn't mean you shouldn't be climbing the salary ladder.
Yeah, really good point. And I maybe something that a lot of people haven't even considered, because I think equally as a recruiter, I see a lot of people who are ambitious and that, you know, they're setting their goals at, you know, this is where I want to get to. But actually the reality is that not, as you say, not everybody can become the CEO. There's just not enough jobs to cope with, you know, that everyone being at that level. But two, not everybody will gain that level of expertise. And I think actually having, I suppose, creating a culture where you're giving people the opportunity to become more self-aware about their strengths and weaknesses and where that's really going to get them to, and their willingness to develop the weakness side of things, because ultimately the, you know, developing a weakness takes a lot more energy than, you know, flourishing with a strength. So, you know, I think this is a really key point and something that we don't talk nearly enough about, is the fact that actually helping people find their place is way more important than I suppose trying to necessarily stoke this ambition, because, you know, ultimately, as you say, somebody will get to a point where they're just completely out of their depth.
There is, but the fundamental point, just going back on that, is I really want to make the point here is that we tend to look at value to a business in terms of skill and competence, and we attribute monetary value to that role on that basis. I think there needs to be a bit of paradigm shift to focus on value to the business. And the example I will normally use is the kitchen porter in a hotel kitchen is generally at the lower end of the pay scale. Okay. they do an important job. No matter if you stay in the nicest hotel on the planet, if you're served a meal on a dirty plate, that's the one thing you will take away from your experience in that hotel. So their value to the business shouldn't be about their salary. It should be about their value to the customer experience. And that's why I think where we have a disproportionate salary scale, I think we should be leveling up a little bit based on value to the business, not perceived skill in their role.
Yeah, good point. Leveling up. You had to get the political term in there, didn't you?
Sorry.
Peter and Jacob, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think sort of slightly leading on from that and sort of bringing a few other bits in as well, I think there's a big element here about culture. And, you know, obviously majority businesses will have their sort of mission, vision, values. And I think the majority of any business, whether the hospitality or otherwise, would generally say that, you know, they would sort of preference finding people that fit in with the culture and then seek to develop the skill set rather than the other way around. I think it's, you know, it's often harder to find people, you know, the other way around, and then try and teach the way that you want things to happen. And I think, like we said, you know, diverse, I think Mark was mentioning elements of this. There's, you know, having a diverse team of people, and that sort of encompasses lots of different elements. There's that diversity of skills, because we need that diversity to be able to deliver all the things we need to deliver. And then also that element of diversity for everything else as well. You know, if there's sort of more diverse our teams are, the better that they tend to operate. And if we're too narrow in our approach in terms of the people that we have, then that could be really difficult. And obviously the area of diversity and inclusion is becoming more and more prevalent, which is only a good thing. And then of course that leads to better team cohesion, and obviously a team that feels valued and is cohesive is therefore then going to deliver better service. To Mark's point there about the sort of kitchen porter element, you know, we need the whole team to succeed in order to be able to deliver the end goal. And it's a bit of a cliche, but you know, we are only ever as strong as our weakest link, and we need to make sure that every part works to the optimum level.
Yeah, and don't worry about a cliche. We like cliches on here. Cliches, political statements, they're all welcome here. Jacob, any bits to add? I'm conscious I keep coming to you last.
Oh, that's okay. Coming from an operations background, I will add that the focus on employee well-being and work-life balance is something that I think we need to do a little bit better about. When you and Mark were speaking about, you know, wanting people to choose this as a career for life, that can be a very challenging vision to sell to somebody when we're asking them to work every night, every weekend, every holiday, these long hours. We have to find a way to strike some kind of balance in taking care of our staff so that they feel as though they are still having a life and actively participating in the operation, and we don't just burn them out in a couple of years to where they want to run away from the industry entirely.
Yeah, great point. And actually, I see this now as well, again, with my recruiter head on. So many more people ask the question now around what are the hours, and then when you tell them that, you know, especially for things like new openings where there might be, you know, it's always just historically been that a new opening just seems to be a bit more of a crazy time, a lot of people will say I will come in and do my 40 hours and that's that. So either you can't reject everybody on that basis. The industry has to figure out a way, I suppose, to mold itself to that, and therefore, in by doing so, and this is, you know, I'm not suggesting there's a quick overnight success to this by any stretch of the imagination, but by doing so, at least we are telling people that, you know, we are serious about creating great places to work that actually fit what you want, not that you have to come and fit into what we want. But I think it was you, Mark, that used the word balance, or was it you, Peter? Somebody used the word balance. It's just, that's the key thing, isn't it, really, is finding the balance between what the employee wants versus what the company can offer, you know, but still you're still trying to push people and, you know, get them to become the best versions of themselves and all of that kind of stuff. It's a tricky one, but I think it's the industry's getting better at this.
I think one of the things that the hospitality industry has always been good at is that training and development piece, because like we sort of talked about, there's this real element of people within hotels, hospitality, developing from entry-level positions all the way up to very senior positions. And, you know, a lot of people do that not having come through a hospitality education background. So there will, of course, be some people who come through a hotel hospitality school, business school background, and maybe they enter the ladder slightly higher. And there's obviously different routes that people take. But I think the training and development angle is really important, because, you know, Mark was talking about the sort of job for life element, and it may be, you know, people work within a hotel brand or organization or property, but then within that they are working in lots of different roles. They're, you know, starting in say, a front office supervisor position, then they work up to be a front office manager, then maybe they work up to be a guest relations director, then they work from there to go up to be an assistant GM, and then maybe to go on to be a general manager of a hotel. And the only way they will do that is by being supported by the business and being trained to develop the skills and knowledge they need to be able to do that. So I think there's that culture of doing that, which is really important within hospitality, which of course exists in lots of other businesses and business areas too. But I think I see it especially across hospitality.
Absolutely. Any additions to that before we move on to the next one, James?
I'll make a final point, Phil. My experience of managing hotels, and I entered as a corporate graduate and then worked up to general manager. And I know lots of people in the sector, and you ask them, you know, where did you get your position? And the majority, and this is my experience only, is they got there by changing job. In other words, from moving from one employer to another. So they moved because they increased their salary and they perceived they increased their position, advanced their position. And so they had to move. And that's unfortunate. And the reason it's unfortunate is because they were clearly valued by somebody else more than they were the current employer. That they felt they had to leave, and they were offered better terms to leave. And I don't think that's a shame.
Yeah. I suppose.
But it's good for the recruitment sector, though, Phil.
It's great for the
very good for the recruitment sector.
No, but you know what? I've spoken about this on many forums before. You know, at the end of the day, I suppose recruitment and any third-party based service that we offer along those lines exists because there is a disconnect somewhere in the whole system. So we're there to plug that disconnect. So, you know, if one day that disconnect does not exist, I'll be the happiest guy on earth, because it means that we're creating the greatest workplaces with the best opportunities to help people get to where they want to get to. But, I think they're coming back to realism on that, you know, especially because the industry evolves so much. And there's always that shiny new thing that's coming into market that, regardless of how happy you might be in your current role, you see something else with wide eyes and go, I'd love to be involved in that. You know, there's all manner of reasons, I suppose, why people do move on in the end. I think the money element of this, the salary discussion, whilst it's been down the list, I think in terms of the psychological reasons why people will go somewhere, I think in the current times that we live in, that's come back up the rankings a little bit again, because as you said, you know, cost to get into work is higher, cost to pay your rent is higher, cost to put food on the table is higher. All of these things that then have a knock-on effect if you're not getting, you know, a salary that helps you live the life that you want to lead. So, but in any case, that's probably a whole podcast discussion in itself around that. So I'm going to come back to a point you made in your kind of intro, Mark, which speaks into, I suppose, where you specialize. And this is not to pick on Mark in any way, shape or form. We'd hope that you guys can also jump in with your thoughts on this, but it's actually just the overall sustainability piece in terms of having that focus and the benefit of having that focus. If you could speak to us, I suppose, very quickly, just around why someone should have that as part of their overall, I suppose, mantra for building a stable business.
Well, there's a number of reasons. Some of them are regulatory, that you just need to do it. You have to do it, or you're penalised for not doing it. But I think, more importantly, it's the expectation of a growing customer base, that the businesses that they purchase from and who service their needs are conscientious and diligent around these matters. And I think, from my experience, some businesses wholeheartedly embrace it. Some are slightly reluctant. And the reason why they're reluctant is because, and I think we do this as a society a little bit, is we focus on the destination of net zero. And that's a huge, onerous task. We just need to start on the journey. Just start on the journey, little by little. And for the hospitality sector, you know, they deliver services to a whole broad swathe of society. So they're an ideal place for this to kind of, as an example. And if I use the example, if I walk into any hotel in London, I'm pretty confident nobody would be able to tell me the amount of energy they used today, yesterday, or the last week, or last month, or how much carbon or greenhouse gas they produced. I doubt there's any. But there's no reason why they shouldn't be able to do that, because I think customers are increasingly anticipating that level of transparency in their business. And I think their teams want to understand that level of transparency in the businesses that they contribute to. I don't think it'll be too long before third-party providers, the dot-coms, will start putting this on their websites, which hotel is, in inverted commas, the greenest. So I think when we go back to, you know, the part about changing the rules and about change, I think for us, it's about encouraging people to get ahead of things, because it's only to your advantage, not only from an operational point of view and saving costs because you're using less energy, but because you're espousing, you know, the message that your client base wants to hear. There's also a regulatory framework called Scope 1, 2, 3, which you'll be aware of. So everybody's involved in this, whether it's your corporate base, whether it's leisure base, whether it's your suppliers, all of this. So really, you know, I think there's an opportunity for leadership. What I do, we currently service over 20,000 bedrooms globally in terms of managing their energy. So people are out there. And a lot of those are brands that people will recognize. And I had this conversation with somebody recently. He said, well, hang on, but that's because they can afford to do that. No, it's not about that. It's about the willingness to do it and to embrace it. So the reason a lot of the larger brands have gone first is not because they have the resources to do it. It's because they are under greater scrutiny to be transparent. So there's no reason why any operator within the sector can't get on that journey of energy reduction and use that as a selling point to reach out and give a positive message to your current and future customers.
Yeah, so I suppose in very, very simplistic terms, having a little bit of a focus on the bottom line benefit that would come with having a sustainable focus. Let's just talk about the energy element of that as probably the main one that everybody would kind of see straight away. Can also then benefit your top line, because in actual fact, you're presenting, it's almost a marketing tool.
Absolutely. Because the essence of a brand is that you have an emotional affinity with your customer. And my point is the environmental aspect is an emotional affinity that everybody wants to embrace or increasingly embracing. And yes, people should be using that as a marketing tool, I think.
Yeah, got you. Gents, anything to add into that?
Yeah, very happy to come in. I think you know, Mark's covered that expertly in terms of the sort of two sides of it. I think there's always been that element of, you know, if you take obviously hotels as a great, you know, good way to talk about it, there's the element of guests looking to stay with properties who care about the environment. And then there's the element for hotels to deliver that to attract the guests. And there's the element around cost saving. And I think it's generally pretty straightforward to tell when brands really embody those sustainability elements and they live by them. And I think it's also obvious to see when it's being paid lip service to. And I think, you know, thankfully the latter is getting less and less, because, you know, it's not possible now, because everybody, you know, there's so much more focus on this. I think also to Mark's point, I think, you know, you have these really big goals. And I think the hard thing with the sustainability, and we understand this having worked with quite a lot of organizations to assist them with their sustainable strategies, whether that's producing the strategy itself, whether that's how to communicate it, whether it's how to actually act on it, is you need to have those big goals so that people understand that you are focused on getting to that big target. But then you need to find a way of breaking it down into easier to understand elements so that people can actually feel like they're going to be able to help get towards it. Because like you say, if you have that big, you know, 2030 target or 2035 target, people think, well, how does what I'm going to do have any impact on that? Because it feels so insignificant. But if you can break it into smaller chunks as ever, that's a much better way of doing it. So I think that's important. And the final thing that we've seen a lot of is, you know, it's the sustainability angle of the planet, but there's also that wider element of sustainability in terms of, you know, sustainability being about our planet, you know, the sort of people that we have, the communities we serve, and all those other things that sort of filter into that. You can have that wider CSR angle of those things. And again, it links back to the other thing we talked about in terms of when we're wanting to attract the right people to work for us in terms of our hospitality businesses. Again, that's a key component of recruiting the right people who will want to work for businesses that embody these sustainable angles as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Jacob, the view from America, is it as focused as we are here around sustainability?
I don't know if it is as focused, but there definitely is attention on this. And I'm lucky to work for a company that has a large corporate focus on sustainability and reducing our emissions. But as Mark was alluding to, even if just from a sales standpoint, people care about this and people ask about what we are doing to manage these things. And if we're not able to have an intelligent conversation about what we're doing to manage our own pollution, we are just simply going to lose business to our competitors who are ready to have those conversations and make those commitments. So it's an area, whether we really want to or not, and again, thankfully my organization does, but whether we do or not, from just a selfish sales and marketing standpoint, we're really going to have no choice but to get in the boat and row at a certain point.
As a final point, I think we need to look at it in a simple way, is if the cost of the problem is less than the cost of the solution, that doesn't mean we should stick with the problem. So from a corporate perspective, you know, change is never easy and change is never cheap. But if it's for the right reason, we should be doing it.
Absolutely. I'm eminently conscious of time. There's probably one question that I would just like to ask to wrap it up, a very simplistic question, because there are, I mean, we've started this year with quite, you know, not particularly great headlines around the number of closures that are happening, especially in the independent restaurant and pub scene. So there's a lot of businesses out there right now that I think are, I suppose, living day to day, really, in terms of, so how do you manage that kind of, the need to get money in the door now versus actually focusing on something that's, you know, that can lead to your long-term stability, as it were?
I think there's a number of things on that. And I think it sort of links in, again, with a bit of a cliche in terms of it's always important to have that short, medium and long-term planning, because if you don't focus on the short term, then the medium and the long term will be irrelevant if you don't survive to see it. You know, there's the element you sort of mentioned there about sort of living day to day. And I think one of the, you know, the largest issues for the hospitality businesses you sort of referenced there will be cash flow. And, you know, that, you know, another cliche just to wrap that one up, cash is the sort of the key component there. If you don't have it, then you're not going to survive. So it's having that exposure to understanding exactly where you're situated. And, you know, I'm not suggesting that businesses would be shying away from that, but it's having the awareness of exactly what the situation is for you. So, you know, if you don't have that data available to you, if you don't have an accurate foresight of your P&L, your cash flow, your balance sheet moving forward, if you're not aware of those commercials to an incredibly in-depth level, then that's when you're going to suffer. The more you know, the better you can plan to it. You know, it's like, again, if you know, if you can't measure it, you can't control it. So you're going to need to know, you're going to need to know those things. And, you know, from experience, that's one of the things that we worked on quite a lot during the pandemic. As a good example, this is not a plug really, but we launched something called the Hotel Forecast Toolkit to help hotels during COVID, help to more quickly forecast and manage those things. So that was a program which helped people to, hoteliers be able to more quickly put together a forecast for their hotels moving forwards in terms of a P&L and a cash flow, so they could see what they had on the horizon and then they could plan for it. So I think that's the sort of initial way that I would see being the most important for those businesses.
Yeah. Jacob, Mark, anything to add into that?
Yeah, I think the key thing with these is if you know there's a problem, acknowledge it. And certainly, you know, you reference kind of, you know, maybe smaller businesses or, you know, restaurants and so forth. Is there's the old saying, there's a cliche for you, a problem shared is a problem solved. No, it's not. It's two people with a problem. And if you have a problem and you get two people on it, you've got more resource dedicated to solving the problem. The third element of this, I would say, if you are one of these businesses, high street or town or village, acknowledge your place in the community. I'm sat in the middle of central London, and there's a little cafe down the street where I use sometimes. If they came up to the office and said, you know what, guys, we're struggling, could you help us out? I guarantee everybody in the office would be buying from there twice as much a week. Reach out to your community and share the problem. And I think that a lot of businesses go, what do I do? Change my format, change my structure. No, no, no. Get out there and let people know you've got a problem and they'll help.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I would say that, you know, yes, of course, there are businesses that are struggling, but there are also businesses that are thriving. So, and we shouldn't forget that, because I think a lot of the time we do talk ourselves into the problems, and but actually, you know, reach out to the people who are thriving. Generally speaking, in this industry, people are really, really willing to share knowledge and practice. Jacob, any wrapped up thoughts?
I was really just going to say, kind of what you just were. When we're encountering these problems, I think it's important to leverage the resources that we have and our connections. I think particularly after COVID, our industry is becoming much more cooperative and willing to help each other for the betterment of the overall industry, instead of just everyone looking out for themselves. And especially in the context of those smaller businesses, to utilize those resources and connections and to get more people to help solve those problems is a great way to move forward.
Yeah, totally. And I think even like to the final comment from me would be, and here's a proper company boy statement, but the IOH is a great platform to actually go and learn about a load of this stuff, you know. So get yourself immersed into the knowledge bank that exists in written form, in podcast form, in just human to human contact form. Yeah, the IOH is an incredible bank of work. So, gentlemen, thank you so much. I'm sure there's absolutely loads more things that we could discuss, but we are out of time. Really appreciate your input on this. Some fabulous points raised. And yeah, thank you so much, and wish you all the very best with your years ahead.
Thank you very much, too.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care. Cheers. Today's episode of I'm In covered building a stable business and featured Jacob Gallen, AIH, Mark Grant, MIH, Peter Russell, FIH, and hosted by me, Phil Street, FIH. A huge thank you, as always, must go to the IOH's very own Sonia Cresswell, MIH, for artwork and branding, and Leon Williams, FIH, for the music. To say I'm In and feature on a future episode, contact phil.street@instituteofhospitality.org. And to find out more about the Institute of Hospitality or to join our hospitality family, please click the links in the show notes. Thanks so much for listening, and join us next time where we'll be exploring retirement and beyond.